The announced subject is the art and I guess the importance of listening. The lament of every parent and every child and every husband, every wife, every teacher, every student at some time or another is, you have ears but you do not hear. I feel that I am qualified to discuss this subject because I've been married for 30 years. 30 years and 1 month, in fact. Now, we have many examples of bad listening everywhere in these places I've named. And I recognize it in my own home, in our own church, in our community, and in the university in which I spend much time, especially among the students. And that's why I wear buttons like I'm wearing today. I couldn't find the third one, but the one button says, "I am not understood." And much of the problem is also what this one says, "I am a human being, do not hold, spindle or mutilate." I had another one that says, "This is just an attempt at communication." And that's sort of, well, it's a big problem. And I could tell probably many stories about examples of this. One I might have told here before some years ago. It happened to a neighbor of ours, Janet Wood, in Richland. And Janet was a very, very attractive girl. And I don't think she fully realized this, which was one of her beauties. And she was finishing high school. And she wanted to sort of get away from home for a while. Her mother kept a pretty tight rein on her. That probably sounds unusual to you people now, but she did. And so Janet picked a denominational school, a couple of thousand miles from home. And since it was a good school and it was their church school, the family decided that that's probably a good idea. And just before Janet left for school, her mother had a heart-to-heart talk with her. She said, "Now, Janet, you'll be going to this school, and you'll probably be having lots of dates. There'll be lots of boys there, and they'll be asking you to go out. And as time goes on, you'll probably become very fond of one of them. And perhaps some night, when the moon is full, maybe you'll go to some function or something, and he'll take you out for a ride in his car and probably go up in some shady lane and park the car, turn off the lights, and then he'll put his arm around you, and that's when your mother will start to worry." And with that, she said goodbye. Well, this was in the fall, and Janet didn't come home for Thanksgiving because it was too far away. But she came home at Christmas time. And you know how it is, those of you who are my age, when the kids come back, it's really a great time. And it was no different in the Woods family when Janet arrived back in town for the Christmas holidays. And she was just bubbling over, and it wasn't long before she found herself alone with her mother in the kitchen. And she says, "You know, Mother, it's just like you said. I had a great time this fall, went out with a lot of boys, and then, as you probably figured from my letters, I sort of concentrated on Dave.
I don't care where that is.
And it's just like you said, you know, the other night, there was a function at school, and And Dave asked me to go out with him afterwards, and we went out of town, and it's it's a big hill there, and we went up and kind of a park, and moon was full, and he pulled up there and parked the car and turned off the motor and the lights, and then he put his arm around me. And I remembered what you said, so I took his arm from around me, put my arm around him, and said, "Now let your mother worry about you." Well, I don't think that's what her mother really meant. That's not very good listening, and we have examples of it. I won't go into some in my own family. But it's a very big problem. And as we examine this, and as listening to Carol this morning and other times, and many other people, you know, and what Luther said about hearing and the importance of listening and hearing. In the surveys, we find that 98% of what we learn through our eyes and our ears. And there have been surveys done on this as to how we use our time. When I was working with General Electric Company for many years, we would make analysis of how we spent our day. We'd keep track of it for say a week at a time to find out, you know, how you waste your time, and it's very revealing. Well, in this particular survey, I think it was by a fellow named Rankin, but I'm not sure, in Ohio, and he had the cooperation of quite a large group of people, and he analyzed their time spent in communication during, say, I think it was a month or so, to find out, you know, just how are they spending the time. And he found out that about 70% of their day was spent in communication, 9% in writing, 16% in reading, about 25% or so in speaking, and almost 50% in listening. Now, depending on your situation, some of you students are spending more time than this listening. Yet as one analyzes how one has prepared for this, you come to realize that you've spent much of your academic life learning how to read, learning how to write, even though we don't do it very well, but you spend a lot of time at it. And you've spent now more than we used to. Spent considerable time in learning how to speak, and that's well that we do that. But we have spent very little time in learning how to listen. We spent very little time in comprehensive listening. And that's very bad. Now, there have been some changes made in the last 20 years. Several people have become very interested in this. One of the people was a fellow from Minnesota named Nichols. Engineer, he was an engineer, and he's done considerable experimental work in this area. And he did some surveys on this, following some work by one at Columbia University. And these are professors like myself, and have had similar experiences, I guess, to me. You get up and you give a brilliant lecture, or you give a series of brilliant lectures, you know. And then you test the student on what you thought he should have gotten from these lectures. And then you read the test papers and you cry. And this has been the experience of, I guess, almost every teacher. These students just aren't listening, you know. You never want to blame it onto yourself. So, they couldn't really believe some of the results they obtained. At Columbia, they found out that sort of an average was about a 50% retention of the material that was presented. And if he waited a couple of months, it was down to 25%. Now, we've also found this in industry. There been many surveys in industry, and what the management thinks that gets down to the man on the line sort of is a lot different from what really gets there, or going the other way. It isn't so bad going from, say, foreman to foreman. They communicate better, and they listen better, and they understand one another, and there's nonverbal communication, and so that is indeed much better. But by the time, you know, it went from Ralph Cordner down to me, There were a lot of things that were lost or gained in the process. And there have been many bad examples of this. We could do it right here, and I could whisper something to you, and we could pass it around, and I wouldn't recognize it by the time it came here. Well, that was their experience, and when Nichols read of this in Minnesota, he says, boy, you know, and that was at a time when they had pretty good students in Columbia. And he said, well, we probably got better ones here in Minnesota. And so he did a survey, and in fact, he brought in some of the best teachers that he could find. And he says, I want you to give them 10 minutes of your best lecture. And then give me the questions that hit the highlights of your lecture so we can test to see how they do. And he found out that the results were essentially the same, that 50%, there was an average of about 50% retention of what he considered the important point, and he didn't have to wait 2 months, he could wait just a couple of days, and it was down to 25%. Well, and he then surveyed, he found out some things that I've just told you, and he said, well, what do we do about this? We got to do something. He looked at the literature to find out, is there anything being done on listening? He surveyed the literature, and he picked out about 3,000 articles that he thought were quite good in communication. And of all these articles, there was only one on listening at that time. That was, I think, in the early 50s. He surveyed the schools to find out, the colleges to find out if anybody was teaching anything about listening. He found one school. And they taught it as one of the social graces. It was girls' college. I know some of those girls, and they've done quite well. But that was the state of things at that time. Now, things have improved. There are many courses in the art of listening. Minneapolis Honeywell, I think, does one, and the Army does it, and many other people. And they found that it is a teachable thing. And so things are looking up. Now, what did Nichols do? Well, when you have a problem like this, you bring in the shrinks and you make out some tests and find out, you know, what's going with these fellows that don't listen well. They found out, you know, who are the bad listeners here? What are the characteristics of the bad listeners? And we'll sort of categorize these by the tests we give. Now, you can question some of the tests, but now I'm going to tell you about some of these things they found out and some of the things that I have found out about the qualities of a bad listener, and maybe you can identify yourself there, and then we can probably do something about it. Now, the first thing that the bad listener does, he decides that the subject is uninteresting or not useful to him. And I'm sure that's sort of the way today. I mean, you know, a lot of people heard about this and says, well, you know, who needs that? I got 2 ears and I've been doing it all my life. And, you know, there isn't anything to learn about this. We're often trapped, you know, in these kind of things. We get trapped in a lecture. And some of them are pretty lousy lectures. But I can't really recall any lecture that I haven't gone to that when I really accept the challenge to see, is there something good in that? I'll probably find out something that I didn't know before or get some different view of it. So you want to accept this challenge. G.K. Chesterton said there's no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, just uninterested listeners. He was a favorite author of mine even before I knew that he loved pigs, and he said pigs were beautiful. And maybe sometime before you leave, I'll tell you about how pigs are beautiful. Another thing that the bad listener does is to criticize the speaker for ineptness, or he becomes overstimulated. And I'll give you a few examples of this. Say, that's Paul. You know, I was going to dedicate this thing, this lecture, to Paul. You know, Paul comes up, Paul... Fanning, you know, he comes up here, and he never gives any lectures, you know, formally, that is. He gives quite a few under the tree. But he's really a professional listener, and he keeps the lectures honest, or relatively honest. And I had planned that I was going to dedicate this thing to him, and I'm reminded in my dedication of the Camp Kelly Glee Club You know that, what is it, Miss Peach, isn't it, the cartoon? And the one, the fellow I identify with there, I often identify with, is Arthur. Remember him? Well, the Camp Kelly Glee Club is going to meet, and Arthur is asked to go over and sit in the listener section. And somebody says, you know, a wiseacre, there's always one in every, at least one in every crowd, and he says, what's wrong? You know, can't you sing? And old Arthur comes out with this. We listeners are chosen for our earnestness of expression and our quietness of breathing. And I think that's really great, and that's, I dedicated to Paul, but I wasn't too sure of it. You know, I was all set to do this. And then Paul told me something this morning. You know, I asked him how that prayer group went yesterday afternoon at 4. And he says, well, frankly, he says, I went to sleep up there on that pad, but I do believe in prayer because I started to snore, and Mary was sitting a little ways away, and she was praying that I'd wake up and quit snoring. And he did. He woke suddenly up. So thank you, Paul.
Thank Mary.
Thank Mary, too. Yes, thank you. Now, I'll turn when the appropriate moment comes, Paul, so you can see what I'm up to here. Smile very much. Now, I remember, I think that one of the first times I gave this talk, I gave a modification of this talk to a professional student, some of the professional students at the University of California, Davis. And it was a large room, and, you know, there were tiered seats up there. And this was in the days when students wore ties. And they wore string ties, remember? Some of you can't remember. Maybe some of you still wear. That's all right. But you know, they wear these very narrow ties. And you just, at that time, wouldn't be caught dead with a belly warmer. You know what I mean? Those wide ties. I always say my ties. And that day, my son had given me a belly warmer some years before. And so I put this thing on. And usually for my lectures, I wear a gray, long gray coat. And I was introduced, and I walked up to the podium. And I let my coat fall to the side, and I looked over the audience, you know, and I could just see them, you know. You know, they were going like this, and for other reasons than the tie, you know. Or the same thing, some of you don't know me here today, and as I walked up here, he said, you know, look at that old gummer, you know? He's wearing that old fatigue outfit from the First World War, and he's wearing a tie with it, you know? I mean, how crazy can you get? Well, this tie is one, you better not make too much fun of it, because my wife made it for me, according to the specifications. And it's got a zipper on it. It's the only utilitarian tie made. And I have notes in it, you see? And for those of you who frequent these veins of our society, the cocktail party, I'll lend it to you because you go there, and as the evening wears on, some guy will come to you, and he'll put his arm around you, and he will say, hey, buddy, the fly on your tie is half open. The other thing, one evening I went to speak to some ladies, and they didn't have a podium. So I got up on a chair this way so I could kind of see what I was talking to. I always do that when I talk to women. And I got up in a chair just like this. And boy, their all eyes went like that. And they even started writing notes to each other, you know. You know, like, look at that crazy professor. He's got one green sock and one orange sock, you know. And they shook him up. Now, I could go through a lot of other things, the examples of this, where you get taken up with this, and what is the hazard of this? Or you can take after the way I talk, because I learned another language before I learned American, and so this sometimes shows, and I stumble along, and one can criticize that. And while you're doing this, you aren't hearing what I'm telling you. And sometimes, as I tell my students, well, I don't tell them very much about this, but I admit it, but sometimes maybe my best preparation is the first paragraph. And while they're doing all this, you know, reacting to this, they've missed the point, you see, because they're stimulated by how I look, or probably now how I smell. It's cold water up in there, please. But you know, we get hung up with these things. Another thing that the bad listener does is to become over-concerned with facts and details. You students do this a lot, and sometimes the teachers force you to this because you have to learn, you know, four decimal places or something like this. You get so caught up with these things about when Leif Erikson discovered America and things like that.
You really help.
Just remember in round numbers, it was 400 years before Columbus, you know? That's a pretty good figure. Just in round numbers, you look for, you know, the overall kind of thing. And in the medical profession, the very medical profession, there's so much of this. They do 7 positive cases out of 11 and report at a 63.64% or something like that, you know? And you know how they do it. It's ridiculous when it's maybe about 2/3, you know? It's crazy. Where I tell them the most important biological value, the most important biological figure is a woman's age. And you don't care whether it's 21.1 or 21.
That's why in the Bible there are 1,200.
So don't become over-concerned with facts and tales. Another thing that the bad listener does is to fake attention.
Boy, it was a real problem.
Or in our whole existence, we try to be somebody we're not. And some of the toughest things I've had to do in my life was to be somebody else, to be an actor. I went to a very small high school. It's called East Stanwood. It isn't even on the map anymore. I was from east of East Stanwood. But everybody had to be in the plays, you know. And boy, that was really tough. Or in prison camp, I was a fan dancer. And that was a great show, and I'm glad, you know, that nobody found out about that on the outside. But it was a great show, but it was hard work, you know. Try to be somebody you were not.
Well, I probably heard maybe 12 birds.
And the story I've told her, some of you have heard it before, can just ignore it. But I think it really makes the point so well. And that was the occasion of the very depressed fellow who comes in to see the psychiatrist. It's late in the day. The psychiatrist is about ready to close shop. And he tells him about his condition and his problems. And they were deep and serious problems. And he was lowering a snake in a wagon track. That's the diagnosis. And the psychiatrist says, now, what am I going to do for this guy, you know, to kind of tide him over? And then he remembered there was a circus in town. It was a great circus. And he said, I want you to go down there tonight and see this circus. And there is one special act that I want you to see, and that's the great clown. He's the greatest clown I've ever seen. And it was silent. And finally the very dejected fellow said, I am that clown. It's really tough to be an actor, and as you students sit in there in the front row, you know, perched like you're on a racehorse ready for the starting gate, you're wasting a lot of energy, you know, doing this. I don't want you to relax, because the bad listener, well, he can also sleep. He relaxed too much. But remember that. Another thing that the bad listener does is to tolerate a bad performance. And there's one thing that you can say for the Norwegians. I was in Norway one time, my first trip to Norway, and I was asked to give a talk. And it was a national meeting. And I was pretty shaky about this thing because before I left the United States, sometime before, he says, you know, although everybody will be there have had English, you must speak very slowly so that they will understand you. And I says, being young and foolish, I said, well, you know, I'll give part of it to Norwegian. Well, I had some help on it, and I got up there and gave this thing, and the local papers announced it. You know, this fellow had never been in Norway before. His folks were born there, and he gave this thing in a priest Gudbrandsdalen dialect. He gave this scientific dissertation in an Ozark twang, you know. And right afterwards, you know, after this talk and during the banquet, you know, they said, boy, that was a great talk, you know, and, you know, they're giving me all this guff. And about 11 o'clock after, you know, the aquavit was pretty much gone, some of them came up to me and gave me the truth, you know. You know, they told me the words that I'd mispronounced and that word should have been that word. And, you know, they give me the dissection, you know. Well, that's a good thing in a way. And it brings up this whole subject, which I broke the first day of, you know, to what extent is one constructively critical or critical? Now, it depends a lot on the person. Whether you're sort of a Tournier fan or you go along with Tournier or go along with C.S. Lewis. I tend to be a little more C.S. Lewis type guy. I think the chief is more on the Tournier kind of a system. And so you see, although I think she works like C.S. Lewis on me, but unfortunately, I probably work like C.S. Lewis on her, but C.S. Lewis said, no friend is a friend of mine if he doesn't care whether I like, he can see it. In other words, he was very, as Carol said, you know, we got to make this, our conversation more crisp, not only, you know, more lively, but also we have to respect integrity. And we see this in school. I mean, some of your students, I know, maybe you're, well, they're not doing it so much now, David, but when I first came there, I went around and to various lectures to see how the students, well, really how the professors, I want to find out how they did it in the big time, you know. I found out it wasn't such a big time. But in fact, some of the lectures were horrible. Students would have been better not having been there. They could have read a book or something. But I also noticed that the students, they might not see anything on the board. They might be sitting there, and it isn't legible from where they are, or they couldn't hear it, and they'd show slides that you couldn't read. And did the students say anything? No, they didn't. And when I started team teaching, I'd sit back there, and when they didn't say anything, I'd start hollering, you know, I can't hear you, I can't see you. Well, they've sort of taken up now. As you know, the students now are almost too critical, but at least that's better, I think, than the other. But so the favors to me, sure, everybody likes to say, well, you know, that talk helped me out. But it's also helpful to say, you know, I didn't agree with you there. How about this point? In sort of a nice way, you tell a person where he's wrong. And I was very happy working for the General Electric Company in Richland, Washington, and then Battelle took over, and I was happy with Battelle. The reason, although I promised myself someday I will go back into full-time academic work, I wasn't really looking for anything. And the reason I ended up at the University of California was that there was a laboratory there. It was in trouble. It was in trouble for several reasons. But one of the reasons was, in science, they were not critical of one another's work. They didn't give each other the benefit of criticism. They'd criticize the other person to somebody else, but not in dialogue to one another. And I diagnosed this right off. And I said, you know, I'm going to give you the benefit of my criticism. And I expect the same from you, because I don't want you to be a clod, and I don't want you to be a clod, to go out of here when you know I'm doing something wrong or I've made the misstatement. I want you to tell me it's a misstatement before I go out of here and make an ass out of myself. And I'm going to do the same favor for you. And I think we got a pretty good thing going. There's been a much open, kind of much more open than it was, at least. And I told them, the day that I know you're doing something wrong, and you know I know you're doing something wrong, and I don't tell you about it, you're in trouble. Because I don't care enough about you, and you're on your way out. And I told them, the day that I know you're doing something wrong, and you know I know you're doing something wrong, and I don't tell you about it, you're in trouble. Because I don't care enough about you. And you're on your way out. So but you must be diplomatic in most cases about this, at least with some people. With my older daughter, you have to use the greatest of diplomacy. Although she doesn't necessarily use it on me. With our son, you can be pretty direct. And he'll, as direct as you are with him, he'll even be more direct with you. So that's a kind of a good relationship, and it saves a lot of time. Now, of course, some of my associates say, you know, he'll do anything for you, but don't let him. Another thing that the bad listener does is that he shuns painstaking listening. He doesn't practice, you know, comprehensive listening. What did these students watch were such bad listeners that Nichols looked over? You know, they watched the Democratic National Convention, or Red Skelton, or I Dream of Jeannie, and you know, trash like that. Where, you know, you might have made the fourth grade, but you didn't have to get into the fifth. And, you say Republican National Convention, too. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. It doesn't take really comprehensive listening. Where there are some pretty good things, I think, on TV, that where you really pay attention and listen. So you can only learn it by painstaking listening. That's how you do it. Instead of shunning, you know, hard things to listen to. Another thing that the bad listener does is he allows emotional words to throw him or her. I don't know what your hang-ups are. I mentioned Christopher Columbus here earlier, you know, or Leif Erikson, huh? You know, when somebody mentions Christopher Columbus, you know, I know Leif Erikson got here before him. Or for some of you, it's Harry Truman, I don't know, Governor Wallace, the pill, topless, grass. You know, some of these words, you have your hang-ups, and as soon as you hear them, you know what you do? You quit listening, and you start thinking about, you know, it gets you going about this thing. I guess now, probably in a religious context, it would be tongues, altar fellowship, closed communion. I know that the other night, you know, boy, you're off and running, boy, you're out there. Instead of trying to listen to what that person says. And now the next three are sort of related. The bad listener also maintains a polite silence while rehearsing in his mind or her mind the speech that they're going to give at the first opportunity. Boy, just making a note here now. Boy, we'll get him, huh? The other, very much related to this, the bad listener waits alertly for the speaker to make a flaw. He looks for the flaws in the speaker so that he can really mow him down when the time comes. And related to this is, I think, one of very important points, is that the bad listener questions for victory rather than clarification. And I don't care where that is. And I'll tell you one place where it happens so much, and that's in the family, within husband and wife, you know. Boy, you give them a bad time, you know. Boy, I'll beat them on this one, you know, and or her. And that's how we do it. And I know of a couple. I think they lived 5 or 6 years together, and boy, it was just like Mrs. O'Flaherty and Mrs. What's-Her-Name across the fence. You know, boy, one would say one thing, and they were off and running and fighting. You know, no matter what they said, the other one always took it the wrong way. And this particular couple, boy, that's how they went. That's how things went for them, and it was going for bad, the worst, and they finally says, you know, it's either the end or we better see a counselor. Well, they did agree on one thing. They'd go and see a counselor. And this counselor sort of diagnosed the issue, because he's been talking for a little bit. And he said, I'll tell you what I want you to do.
When you get in a situation where, you know, unless, you know, pass the butter, where it's pretty clear or something like that, you know, where you might have misunderstood, I want you to say, all right, the way I heard that is this, you know, and you repeat what they said. And this couple started this, and pretty soon they started laughing because they really hadn't been communicating, you see. So remember that. You question for clarification, not for victory. And the same with, in sessions here. I mean, we're all tempted by this, aren't you? You know, kind of one-upmanship, you know. Boy, I'll get that guy, you know. And our students, I know you students do this, you know. They're doing this to me all the time. But like I tell them, you know, ask your questions. I certainly welcome the questions, but I'm not young enough to know all the answers. Aha, I got you. All right. The other thing that the bad listener does, other than falling asleep, he tunes the speaker out. And I do that myself because, well, many times I'll admit the speaker invites this, because instead of going along at about 200 words a minute, which I'm doing now, and when people go along at about 200 words a minute, most of you will pay very close attention because you're afraid you're going to miss something. And I think if we did more of this, probably there'd be more people paying much closer attention, and if you could pass out your notes, they could check it later. But if you went along like this, well, you could really, you know, boy, you're afraid you'll miss something, you're going to pay very close attention. But most of the things that I go to, and I have to attend a lot of seminars because, I have graduate students and we have visiting dignitaries, and you got to show up for them, and then at the end they kind of expect you to ask an intelligent question. Well, yeah, you know. When I go to these, I always take a lot of stuff. Or when I go to concerts and stuff, as the chief knows, he's kind of embarrassed about it. You know, I always bring my work with me. And I do a lot of my correspondence while I'm listening to seminars and things. And because I've gotten, you know, I'm pretty well equipped here. I have very large ears, and I can hear things, and I've trained myself so that as the person is speaking, he has an experiment he wishes to tell us about. It involved quite a few animals, and he goes up on the board and maybe draws a square, and he says, now and setting up this experiment, you know, and he's going along about that pace, you know. Well, I can shut him off for, you know, many seconds and not miss a thing. Because during the hour, there's probably about 3-4 ideas there that might be new, and that might be stretching a point. So you can, and we sort of invite this in a way. But it's also something you have to fight about, you know, tuning the speaker out. Because you might miss something unless you've had a lot of practice at it. Now, what does a good listener do? Well, a good listener, he tries to see the problem under discussion the way the speaker sees it, which doesn't mean sympathy, that is, you know, feeling for him, but by empathy, which is experiencing it with him. In other words, you try to experience what this lecturer or the discusser is up to. And sometimes maybe you feel sorry for him, that also helps. In fact, I know a few people, Shields Warren, in whose lab I worked for a while. He had a lisp and a stutter, which he practiced very religiously, you know, and especially in court and things. Or he was before Senate committee, because he was director for a while of Chief of Biology and Medicine for the Atomic Energy Commission. He'd always appear before the Senate and House on hearings, you know. And he really practiced this, and he had the sympathy of the audience, you know. And boy, you know, he kept them getting a lot of money. They felt that one. But you try to experience with them, try to see them, you know. This thing of walking, you know, that 2 miles in the moccasins before you really make your criticism. Sometimes we are too soon we make criticism. We make criticism of the speaker too soon. Or you meet someone, and you right away you make a judgment. And it's pretty hard to wipe out. You prejudge this person, whether it's a speaker or someone you meet. The longer you can put off judging a person, the better. Try 100 years. Now, another thing that the good listener does, and as I was going along today, I wasn't speaking very fast. Sometimes I get it as much faster than I gave it today. I'm going to have to speed it up a little bit, because I got a few more things I want to tell you. But you could have today recapitulated. In other words, as I was going through these points, you could have, as I was on number two, you could have repeated number one. When I got to three, you could have repeated number one and two, and you'd have gone through it. So that by the end of the lecture, you have a pretty good feel. Then you could go out and, you know, somebody meets you out here, say, hey, what that old, that old gummer have to say today, see? And you could tell him what the old gummer had to say today, and you could probably hit maybe better than 5 out of 10. Maybe you could make 7 out of 10. Had you recapitulated? Had you looked for a structure for this thing? Because a lot of talks have a structure to them. You see, what was the objective here? And then you kind of, at the end, you sort of write it up. It's all right to take notes. I know some of you are taking notes. That's how I learn best. I even take notes for sermons to see, you know. Well, it's always a challenge to see, you know, did the pastor have an outline? Well, sometimes it's from the Spirit, but sometimes the Spirit has an outline. So you can't blame an unorganized one on that. All right, now I'm going to shift gears a little bit on this whole problem of listening and the problems with it. And at this point, I often recall, and it's helpful to some, what John Godfrey said about this. John Godfrey, his folks came to this country as immigrants, and they were very wise, because they knew that lawyers and Rotary run the country. And so they wanted their son to be a lawyer. Now, he didn't really want to be a lawyer, but he ended up being one. And he was a fair lawyer. He really wanted to be something else. And he amassed a considerable amount of money because he bought a lot of land in his small town built around him. So he ended up with a pot full of money. And he got to be about 75, and he thought he better do something about this. His wife had been dead for a long time. Decided to build a building dedicated to her. And so he did. And he kept it a secret as to what he was up to. And of course, a lot of curious people coming by, you know, what's the old joker up to? And he wouldn't tell them. And finally, this very beautiful building was completed. And it was indeed impressive because he'd hired the best architects. The money was not a problem. And they noticed that inlaid in gold over the door were these words, "The man who listens." And at the dedication, he said gently by way of explanation, "One of the most terrible aspects of this world today is that nobody listens to anyone else. If you are sick or even dying, nobody listens. If you are bewildered or frightened or lost or bereaved or alone or lonely, nobody really listens. Even the clergy are hurried and harassed, and they do their best and work endlessly. But time has taken on a fragmented character. It doesn't seem to have any substance any longer. Nobody has time to listen to anyone. Not even those who love you and would die for you. Your parents, your children, your friends. They have no time." That's a very terrible thing, isn't it? Whose fault is it? I don't know. But there just doesn't seem to be any time. Well, these are really true words, but they're really from fiction from Taylor Caldwell in The Listener. But they are true, and unfortunately true, which is so well, I think, pointed out in the next article, which I'll read. It's a brief letter from Creative Brooding by Rain. And it's entitled, "Too Busy to Listen." "Dear folks, thank you for everything, but I'm going to Chicago and try to start some kind of a new life. You asked me why I did those things and why I gave you so much trouble, and the answer is easy for me to give you, but I'm wondering if you will understand. Remember when I was about 5 or 6, I used to want you to just listen to me? I remember all the nice things you gave me for Christmas and my birthday, and I was really happy with the things for about a week at a time that I got the things. The rest of the time and during the year, I didn't want presents. I just wanted all the time for you to listen to me like I was somebody who felt things too. Because I remember even when I was young, I felt things. But you said you were too busy. Mom, you're a wonderful cook, and you did everything so clean, and you were tired so much of the time from doing all the things that made you so busy. But you know something, Mom? I would have liked crackers and peanut butter just as well if you'd only sat down with me for a while during the day and said to me, tell me all about it so that I can maybe help you understand. And when Donna came, I couldn't understand why everyone made so much fuss, because I didn't think it was my fault that her hair was so curly and her skin so white. She doesn't have to wear glasses with such thick lenses either, does she? Her grades are better, too. Donna ever has children, I hope you will tell her just to pay some attention to the one who doesn't smile very much, because that one will really be crying inside, and when she's about to bake 6 dozen cookies to make sure for that the kids don't want to tell her about a dream or a hope or something. Because thoughts are important, too, to small kids, even though they don't have so many words to use when they tell you about what they have inside of them. I think that all the kids who are doing so many things and grown-ups are tearing out their hair worrying about are really looking for somebody that will have time to listen a few minutes and who really and truly will treat them as they would a grown-up who might be useful to them, you know, or polite to them. Few folks had ever said to me, pardon me, when you interrupted me, I'd have dropped dead. If anybody asks you where I'm going, tell them I've gone looking for somebody with time, because I've got a lot of things I want to talk about. Love Your Son. It's by Juno Delinquent. I submit that without comment. Now, one of the notes I pulled out of my tie here was to say, give him a little Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Now, Jim's been giving you some Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and I may even give you some more tonight, but in his Life Together, he said the first service that one owes to others in the fellowship consists in listening to them. Just as love to God begins with listening to His Word, so the beginning of love for the brethren is learning to listen to them. It is God's love for us that He not only gives us His Word, but also lends us His ear. So it is His work that we do for our brother when we learn to listen to Him. Christians, especially ministers, so often think they must always contribute something when they're in company of others. That is, that this is the one service they have to render. They forget that listening can be a greater service than speaking. You know, I mean, pastors and professors are alike, you know. You're always feeling a lecture coming on, you know, or, you know, you've got to... And that ain't good. I'm going to read one little more thing here on this, and then I'll give you a little from my own experience. Secular education today is aware that often a person can be helped merely by having someone who will listen to him seriously. And upon this insight, he has constructed its own soul therapy, which has attracted great numbers of people, including Christians. But Christians have forgotten that the ministry of listening has been committed to them by him who is himself the great listener and whose work they should share. We should listen with the ears of God that we may speak the word of God. And I think that's well spoken by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, or Bonhoeffer, or however you wish to pronounce it, but you know who I mean. Now, in my own experience, and I mentioned it the other night, a dialogue that we set up, mainly for this, because so many students, they leave the university and they never knew a professor as a person, they never knew a technician as a person, or they never knew anybody in the town as a person. They know a few students, and that's it. And that's bad, you know, that's really bad. And you ask the professors, and do they really know a student as a person? And not very many of them really do in some of the places I've been. That's why we set up a dialogue where you meet 5 times, say, in a quarter, in persons' homes, and maybe in the student's home. And we start them off in our home with that film some of you saw, Why Man Creates. And these people, then you... And the one thing we do, which is threatening to many, and I've had some faculty drop out of this. One faculty member, he had 2 PhDs. He had an MD and a PhD, and he's really proud of it. And they found out, you know, the first night that nobody had a doctor in front of him, you know. No doctors in front of their name. Everybody was on a first-name basis, and that's pretty threatening to some people with titles. Let's get that facade away. I know from my own experience, I got five more minutes and then I'll finish up. Pardon? Yeah, the bell is early. I know from my own experience that, you know, people have come to me, a few of them, and said, you know, you really helped me out that time. And I'd say, boy, you know, I must have given this person some advice. I'm free with advice. And I must have really, you know, what brilliant thing did I tell them? And as I think about it, I find out I hadn't told them probably anything at all, but I had listened to them. And that's a great minister. Now, in my closing here, and we'll let the little kids get out if they want to go out, and then I want to give you my last few thoughts on this. And that's, you know, I mentioned all these people that had trouble with listening. Well, God and the prophets had the same trouble. And that's why in the Bible there are 1,200 references to hearing and listening. I didn't read them all before this, but I read quite a few. And boy, it was a real problem. Now, the other night, or other day, somebody said, well, how do you listen to God? Well, we must, as important as all this other listening is to these people, we must first listen to God. And where do we hear him? Well, Al Rognes said you either hear him everywhere or you hear him nowhere. And part of this is sort of knowledge of God, I guess, and pointing out to it. And sometimes I use the reference of the bird. Sometimes when in a morning, I used to open up a lecture and I'll say, how many birds did you hear coming down here today? Birds, you know, who heard any birds coming down here? You know? Well, I probably heard maybe 12 birds from the upper end of the village down to here, you know. You don't hear them if you're not listening for them, you know. To hear God is to hear him in Jesus Christ. First, it's a local voice before it becomes a universal one. You hear him in one place before you hear him in every place. God remains just a vague mystery and a hidden power, and therefore not the great God of creation, until you have him in the person of someone who walked among us. The roar of the cascading streams here remains just a roar. The rustle of the wind in the trees remains just a rustle. Nature speaks only her own language unless you have heard God speak to you through Jesus Christ. Happy is the man, the woman, the child who has tuned his ear to the living word. Then everything begins to speak of God. Know his love and you know his majesty. Know his love and you can see his handiwork in the intricate and complex designs of our creation. But there is a risk in listening to him, for then you risk hearing the other voices, the groans, the cries of the unfortunate of the world, people with problems even as close as your own home or the house next door. Now, there are many stories and many statements that we can listen to and remain undisturbed. They leave us in peace. Grass is green, the sky is gray, and H2O is water. When I hear these statements, my life really remains unchanged. But there are other things that are very disturbing to me, and if you'll pardon me, I'll recall a personal experience. One day, a long time ago, perhaps almost 31 years ago, on a night in which there was a full moon, the chief said to me, I love you and I want to marry you. Maybe it was the other way around, but anyway, for this purpose, that was. Now, when I heard that, I just didn't go home. I said, you know, I didn't say good night. I didn't go on home, take a drink of buttermilk and sit down and turn on the Richfield Reporter on my Atwater Kent radio or my crystal set. You know, I hit the pad and go to sleep. This was a very threatening thing. because I had to either say no or give my heart to this person. And that's really the way God's call is to us. The old, old story of Jesus and his love is like that. We cannot listen to the story and the word that Jesus bar Joseph, the carpenter of Nazareth, was in fact and in truth, in the most exact and literal sense of the word, the God by whom all things were made. He was not merely a man so good as to be like God. He was God. We cannot face the cross where Christ died to forgive our sins so that we might obtain sonship. We cannot hear this story and do nothing. We must either escape the tormenting reach of the story by rejecting him, or be caught up in the wonderment of it all, in the sheer wonder of his love. He that has ears to hear, let him hear. For the Lord is near to all who call upon him, who call upon him in truth. Amen.